The term steamboat days has a special meaning in the Yukon. It was almost a way of life. Our seasons were gauged more by the first boat and the last boat. One meant excitement and anticipation, the other meant isolation and a sense of being left behind. A feeling which soon passed, but it was a low spot in our lives. Rivermen are few now, but one not only was a steamboat man himself, but I think that John Hoggins' father was also a man of steamboat days. And Johnny, what was your very first memory of steamboating?
Well, my first memory of steamboating was along about 1910, after we came out of the Kluane country. Dad joined the BYN and was on the river as a mate on the old Dawson. And that fall, we went down to Hootalinqua, where the White Pass used to winter their boats. They used to winter the old Canadian there because they wanted to get a big boat away to Dawson with all the freight they could in the early spring, and they couldn't get through the lake till around about the first part of June. So they had the smaller boats up at the foot of the lake, and they used to come down the 30 mile and load the Canadian, and when she would take off about, oh, maybe the 23rd, 24th of May for Dawson, right behind the ice. And that way they got a boat down early. Well, that is my first remembrance of the steamboating. And as the old Canadian, they used to lay the boat up there in the slough. And the watchman, he went down there after the last boat went up. They'd leave this boat there and pick up the crew. And the watchman was left there, and he'd be there till break up in the spring.
Did your father come into the country, Johnny, as a steamboat captain?
No, he was a deep sea captain but he was in Antwerp, I believe, when the gold rush started, and he got the fever, and they bought some dogs in Belgium, and him and his partner, I don't remember his name now. I think his name was Moody, and they brought their dogs and came right up to Skagway, and they got there. I think it was early in the spring of 98. And then they started freighting over their stuff over the summit, and they came on through to Dawson in the spring with the big, when all the boats came down.
Mm-hmm. Well, then he went on to the White Pass, and he'd start with Wooden.
Well, he was in Dawson for a while, then he went back to Whitehorse, and he was running scows and boats through the rapids there in the canyon, and he was on the Clifford Sifton when they brought it through the rapids. That was one of the steamboats that came through.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you ever make any trips when you were a youngster? Did you know when you were, 1910, that you would probably be going on the steamboats when you got a little older?
Well, yes. Well, of course, we more or less lived steamboat. That's all we saw along the river there, you know. We were there at Hootalinqua for about 5 years, and we spent some of the summers there. And, of course, as soon as I was old enough, I followed Dad on the river.
How old were you when you made your first trip with your dad?
Well, I was 15 when I first started working on the old steamer dock.
Well, you were crew then?
I was on the crew, yeah, in 1917.
Oh. And what were your duties as the first time on your boat?
Well, I was deck boy. It was, you got up in the morning at 5 o'clock and went up and cleaned the pilot house, shined all the brass, and by that time you went down and swept all the cinders off the passenger deck and hosed it down. And if you were lucky, you'd get through in time to have your breakfast, but you had to have that all cleaned up before the passengers got up.
Mm-hmm.
And then after you had your breakfast, well, you went right back to work again, and you just washed paint and kept the decks clean. And if there happened to be a wood pile, like the boat put in for wood during the day, well, you helped on the wood pile. But you were worked 12 hours ordinary. The only thing, the advantage of being a deck boy is you didn't have to get out at night.
Oh, I see. And then did you just stay with the boats then, Johnny?
Well, I was on the Dawson for one summer, and then the next, two summers I was on the Dawson. And the third summer I was on the steamer Casca. That was the newer Casca. And I was deck boy for a while, acted as second mate for a couple of trips, and also fired on it for a little while.
Well, did they let the kids up in the wheelhouse to get the feel of the ship at all, or were they very formal like they would be on any boat, Johnny, or were you allowed to wander around?
Well, the crew, like I was up, of course, I was allowed in the wheelhouse being the deck boy. I had to go up there to clean it up, and then we had a wood-burning stove up there to keep the skipper and the pilot warm. And some of the skippers and pilots were very good, like in the be going upstream, you know, after I'd been on there a couple of years. I remember Cap Murray, he was one of the pilots. He used to just say, here, you take it for a while, and he'd walk off down below and have a cup of coffee. But going upstream, it was easy to handle, you know, in a good part of the river. Of course, if any of the bad parts of the river, they would never leave the wheelhouse.
What would they call a bad part of the river, Johnny? What would make it particularly dangerous?
Well, some places there's the split channels, you know, and it's very fast water. And the 30-mile was the worst section of the river. That is way from the foot of the lake down to Hootalinqua. It was a series of very sharp bends, and they were rocky. And the last 5 miles, the Rocky Reach, they called it, it was all rocks. They blew a lot of them out of there and made it better, but there was quite a few boats wrecked down through there.
Were you ever on a boat that got into trouble when you were younger, John?
Well, yes, not too bad. We didn't sink or anything, but there were some that did sink while I was on the river. We were coming out of White Horse one fall in the late, and we had a scow load of cattle. We used to bring a lot of live cattle in, and pigs and sheep and chickens and everything in those days. And we loaded up in White Horse, and we left, and it was quite foggy when we left. And we were about, there was a bar right in the center of the river, just below the mouth of Dakina. And we ran out of this scow with the cattle on it, right out high and dry on top of this bar in the middle of the night. And they broke the tow ropes, and the boat came around alongside. But it smashed in a little of the house and that, but nobody was hurt. But you couldn't see a thing. It was that foggy. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a job, because we couldn't unload this livestock to lighten the scow up. And we had to dig dead men in the hillside. And it was all kind of a gooey glacier mud, and run lines, you know, and blocks. And we finally yarded the scow off and started off down the river. And I'll tell you this, if you really want an experience, you want to come down that river behind a scow load of cattle. You know, the you're traveling fast enough, you know, the wind's blowing, and the cattle and the sheep and pigs weren't so much, but you get a bunch of chickens on the top story, and boy, I'll tell you, it runs right through the boat.
How would they go about loading this stuff in White Horse, Johnny? Did they have proper loading facilities for cattle and one thing or another?
Oh, they had a big cattle yard just below White Horse there, where they used to hold the cattle, and they had chutes they'd run them on, and they used to build these three-deck corrals right on these scows, and of course the cattle were on the lower one, and then there'd be pigs and sheep up above, and then on the very top would be chickens, turkeys, and geese, and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff came in on the hoof then.
I was going to say, this has nothing to do with steamboating, but how did they handle all this live stuff when they got it in here?
Well, they, of course, the crew had to feed it on the way down and clean it up as much as we could. And then when they got here, they landed at the dock, and they just drove them off, and we used to hire a lot of the kids in town to herd the sheep and the pigs up to the slaughter yard, which was up above Ogilvie Bridge. And then, of course, they had the men that looked after the livestock when they were here, the cattle and that, they used to run them out in the Klondike Flat there, just around Googieville. That's just above Ogilvie Bridge. They used to come down and herd the cattle, and there were these big red steers. Oh, they were twice as big as the steers you see now. They're tall and big horns. I guess they were something like the Texas Longhorn, but they were awful high.
And it'd be a real cattle drive then, right down Front Street, and you say Ogilvie Bridge, that's quite a ways, isn't it?
Oh, yes, they'd drive them right up through town and up the road up to Ogilvie Ridge Bridge. And they had a big holding pen up there, you know, and a slaughterhouse. They also had another slaughterhouse over at Sunnydale. They used to sometimes take the scow right over in there and unload over there.
And this is just across the river and a little bit upstream from here, isn't it?
Yeah, Sunnydale Slough.
Mm-hmm. Well, Johnny, we've gotten sort of off the track of the steamboat. You always have so many interesting little side stories to tell. And we will let this be all for this first in the series of Johnny Haugen and his steamboating days. And this is Athery Talick in Dawson City. Last week, we were talking with Johnny Haugen about his days of steamboating on the Yukon. And Johnny did mention the type of cargo, and one thing was the livestock. Well, Johnny, besides livestock, you had other types of cargo too, didn't you?
Yes, hay and oats was one of the big bunch of the freight that came through here. There were so many horses in the country at that time, and they used to have scow loads of hay and oats, and the boats loaded too the same way. That was the biggest part of our cargo, I believe, was the hay and oats most of the time in the summer.
Did you drop it off along the way, or did this come straight through to Dawson?
Well, the Dawson area took the biggest part of it. The only time we dropped any off, you know, was when the White Pass stage line, we used to put feed off at their different feed caches, like up at Mendenhall Landing, and they'd freight that to in towards the post between there and Carmax, and then we'd put some off at Carmax for that post, and Yukon Crossing, Minto, and then we used to run up the Pelly about 3 miles, and we'd put off about a scow load there for the, and they would freight that to the posts north that was be Wheeler, Alberta, and then we'd go up the Stewart to Scroggy, and we'd put off there for Black Hills and Quartz Creek, and then the rest of course would come to Dawson.
Well, when you had these barges, how many barges would one of the big boats bring with it then?
Well, we just handled one barge on the upper river. On the lower river, the big boats like the Susie and the Sarah and those boats, they used to leave St. Michael sometimes with 8 or 10 barges because the river's wide, you know, and they were big boats, and they would bring these barges up and drop them off at the different posts along the river, and by the time they got to Dawson, they very seldom arrived here with more than 2 barges. And then, of course, going back, they would take freight from here on those, and then they'd pick up the empties as they went down, and right down to St. Michael's, then they'd reload. They'd only make about 2 trips in the summer.
Oh. Well, Johnny, when your steamboat was scooting in and out all these way stops, did you carry passengers? Would they get an extra trip out of all this?
Well, of course, when we were taking this feed up these side streams, with the odd time we'd have passengers, but mostly it would just be the crew.
Mm-hmm. And then what about going back out? They wouldn't go back completely empty, would they, or would they? Was this like before Mayo? Would there be no backhaul?
Well, at that time there wasn't very little backhaul. About the only backhaul we used to have would be the men that were rafting wood and into town. We used to take their sweep blades and their ropes and their stuff all back up and drop them off on the river on the way up. But that's about all the back freight we had.
Well, then the gold shipments would go out. Did you have any particular protection when you were taking the gold back out?
No, we never. They used to bring it aboard, and I remember one incident. We were loading this gold, and we had the gold all down in the safe in the White Pass office there, and the purser and I went up, and he was supposed to walk with me. I was to carry this gold down. We had a safe up in the observation room by the purser's office that they used to store this in. Going up, it wasn't much of a safe, but it did the trick. And I packed all this gold down, and we were just about ready to pull out, and there was one kind of a sack. It was light, you know, and the purser, he was making out the papers for the rest of this stuff, and he's standing around there, and I just had this little sack, and I thought, well, there's no use me waiting for him. I buzzed off down at the boat, and we were about ready to pull out, and I just threw this sack up on top of some of the wood pile there in the front of the boat and helped the boys pull in the plank, and we started out, and the purser came running around looking for me, and what did you do with that sack? And I said, what sack? Why, he said, that little white sack you had. Oh, I said, it's around here someplace. He said, it better be. So we went looking for it, and I found it up on top of the wood pile, you know. And he said, you know what's in that? And I said, no. He says, $35,000.
Oh, just like that, eh? Well, then, this would be your livestock and your feed and gold shipments. And what else would you bring down, Johnny? I guess just about everything, but there's some things in particular you made a real load of, were there?
Yes, we used to, there was, of course, all the food and that for Dawson came through, and then there was a lot for the side streams, you know, like some stuff went off at Selkirk for to go up the Pelly, and then the Stewart, all the freight for Mayo, it came down that way too, and sometimes they'd unload it at Stewart, and sometimes they'd bring it here and then take it back up and unload it on the way back. Mm-hmm. But and then the coal mine at Carmax was running that time, and on towards fall we used to bring quite a few scow loads of coal down.
Oh, did you? This was for use in Dawson here?
Oh, yes, there was quite a lot of coal used here at that time, and it was good coal, too. It was in the old mine. It came out of the old mine. It's just about where the bridge starts across the river from Carmack's now. It is right under the hill on the Carmack side.
Mm-hmm. Well, that'd be a dirty cargo if you'd have to handle, wouldn't it?
Well, no, it was. There was no handling to that. You see, they used to just pile the lump clo around the outside of the barge and make a kind of a fence, and then they just loaded it with chutes. And when we picked it up, it was all loaded. We didn't have to wait for it. It was all loaded. We just hook on and come down, and then we'd leave it here. So it didn't bother us at all. That was fine. We didn't have any handling to do at all.
Oh, I was thinking in terms of sacks piled up on it. Well, then, were you on the steamboat in the days and used to take all that ore out of Mayo? Would that already be sacked? There'd be tons of that, wouldn't there?
Yeah, well, I was off the river at that time. I left the river in 1921. I was on the steamboats for the 17, 18, and 19. 1920, I went on the Hazel B on the Stewart as pilot and purser on the Hazel B. It was a gas launch that used to run to Mayo. We used to take a scow and freight, you know, up there. And the Guggenheims at that time had started to mine on Keno Hill. And we took all their supplies up with this little boat, and then some of the steamboats used to bring. They didn't have too much ore to come out then. It was a small operation, and the steamboats brought it out. But we used to take the mail and some of the freight up.
I know what I was going to ask you about, Johnny, is the wood. How much wood would one of those big boats take on a round trip? Do you remember?
Well, it was different. The Dawson and the Selkirk and those boats of that size, they burned about 132 cords to the trip. The Canadian, it was a little more. It had burned about 150. And the Casca, they put a big boiler in that. It came out of the old Lightning, and it was the easiest boat on the lot. It used to burn about 78 cords in a round trip. Mm-hmm. Used to figure most of the time around a cord an hour going upstream and, about a half a cord an hour coming down.
How far apart would these wood lots be then, or these refueling places?
Oh, they had them... they were wherever there was wood, you know, they... The lower end of the river here was the worst. Our first wood to pile out of here, if I remember, was used to be around Dog Creek. That's about 32 miles up the river. And then, there was another one at Harlan's Slough just below Stewart. And Stewart River Island, they had wood there. And then at White River Island, it's a big island just out off the mouth of the White River. And then up at Coffee Creek was another wood camp. And they were all along, you know, about, some of them be 15 miles apart, sometimes 30, just wherever there was wood.
It was quite an industry, wasn't it, this wood? Well, were there any times that you brought down cargo that you would rather have had nothing to do with it? You say the chickens were bad enough, but were there other cargoes, too, that were tricky to handle?
Well, the chickens were the worst, but we used to bring powder, too, and, of course, it wasn't hard to handle, but there used to be restrictions on the boat, you know. They used to watch pretty close for fire, and you weren't allowed any firearms on the boat because it was... one year, there was one boat blew up, the Columbian. They were coming... They had a bunch of powder stacked on the bow. It wasn't a cargo of powder, but they had just a few cases, you know, on the bow of the boat. They were bringing it down, and some of the boys were shooting at rabbits along the bank, and somebody shot into the powder and blew up and blew the boat up. Oh. And I remember just how many were killed on it, but that was just below a little salmon. And after that, you weren't allowed to carry firearms with powder, or the White Pass wouldn't allow you to have firearms on the boat at all.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the captains didn't like handling these loads, especially at night, and it got sort of late in the fall. It would be tricky, wouldn't it?
Well, in the fall, coming down, they used to tie up after dark, but going upstream, we ran all night. And, of course, we had fog, too. You'd tie up for fog. But most of the time in the fall, coming down, we'd tie up, you know. And we always try to hit the fingers, five fingers, in daylight.
Mm-hmm. Was there very much to do to get through the fingers, Johnny? Was it a different technique altogether to go through there?
Well, at times, when the water was high, we used to have to pick up the line and pull ourselves through on this line, because when the boat would get part way up... It was more of a chute than a rapids, you know, and the boat would get to be halfway up over this drop in the water, and then the stern wheel would start to come out of the water, and they'd lose their power, and they'd drift back, so they had this line to pull them through, you see, after it was quite a job picking up the line, you know. They'd put that in early in the summer. It was on a big reel up at the upper end of the rapids. And they'd run it down, and it fastened to a ring below, and we used to have to pick that up. But it'd get foul on the bottom in the rocks and that, you know, and we'd get it on the caps, and then we'd have to seesaw back and forward to try and get it loose before we could start through.
Johnny, for us now that are traveling by car, and we can stop there at the Five Fingers, just through which of those channels, what they're for now, aren't there, would the boats go through? They always used the same one then, didn't they?
Yeah, the one closest to the road there is, it looks like the smallest channel. There's really only four fingers there now. They blew the fifth one out. But the far side where it's wide there, that's the rapids. They don't come through there. That's all rocks. But this, the side close to the road, that would be on the right limit. That's the right-hand side coming downstream. Mm-hmm. And you run into this narrow canyon right between the island and the sheer wall on the other side. And after you go through there pretty fast, but just as soon as you get through, you start going full astern with the steamer, and then you got to kind of pull them sideways so to miss a rock below there, and they kind of drift over to one side, and then you're all right. And then below that, of course, we had Rink Rapids, which was just a rocky bottom, and it was shallow water, and it was bad in low water.
Mm-hmm. Well, Johnny, it looks as though we've used up another section of our time in this series of steamboating on the Yukon in the early days. And this is Arthur Italic in Dawson City. For the past 2 weeks, we have been talking with Johnny Hogan about steamboating on the Yukon. And Johnny, for all the beauty of the Yukon River, it was a treacherous river. All the boats didn't come through so effortlessly, did they?
No, there was. They had quite a few wrecks along the river, particularly in the early days. They were smaller boats, but a lot of the rocks that they connected with were blown out afterwards. When you leave Whitehorse, the river is fairly slow until you get to the head of the lake, and then you have the Yukon Flat, or the flats to go over there, and they had to put in a lot of piling and try and divert the channel into one spot there so they could get through when the water was low. And they'd send a boat down there sometimes, and they drop an anchor upstream and back down. They just keep the wheel churning and gradually let the boat down on a line to make a channel so they could get through. But once they got a channel through, then it was nearly always good for the summer. And then they'd go on across the lake, which was 30 miles long. There was, there were several boats went down in the lake, but the only one I think that was really in commercial use was the old Goddard. She went down just off Goddard Point. I don't remember what year it was, but it was early in the steamboat days. Mm-hmm. And the old Thistle, they were towing her down after they got through with her. Taylor and Drury had it for a number of years for their trading posts along the river. They were towing her across the lake, and they got in a bit of a storm, and she sunk. And the old Vidette hit. The same thing happened to it. They were towing it down to the head of the lake, or the foot of the lake, for a mess house, and it broke in two and sank too. But from there down, that was the treacherous part of the river. It always used to be quite a spot for the tourists there. Just below the where they used to keep the boats in the winter, there was a wood pile. It was about 2 miles below the foot of the lake. And Kit Marion, one of the pilots on there, he always used to rig a thing up there for the tourists. He had two sticks driven in the bank, you know, and he cut the legs off of some overalls, and he shoved them in there, and then he put a couple of rubber shoes on these sticks, and he used to tell the tourists when they come along, my gosh, he's putting her in the river. They think it was the corpse in there, and they were just about going in the river. That thing went on for years.
Wasn't he the one that used to let them clean out the ashes out of the boiler, saying it was the ashes of McGee or something?
Oh, yes, he always had some stories.
Johnny, most of the wrecks on the barge were due to wind, were they?
Mostly wind, yes.
You were going to mention something about Marion and some more of his stunts, were you?
Well, he was always jobbing somebody. After you went down through the 30-mile little way, then you came to what they called the Donville. That was a bad bend in the river and very fast water. And the steamer Donville, she was wrecked there in the early days.
When these steamboats were wrecked, Johnny, were they just sort of ram into a rock or something? I mean, they had a very shallow draft, didn't they? What was the danger when these things would... mostly it was hitting rocks, then, wasn't it?
In the 30 mile, it was mostly rocks. They'd hit a rock and then tear the rudders off. They'd go out of control and sink. And they were small, you know, and they'd pile up and just get torn all to pieces because the water's really fast in there.
Were there ever any lives lost in one of these wrecks?
They were all before my time, but there was quite a few that sunk in there. Some boats were raised again that there was no lives lost, but there might have been in the early days. Mm-hmm. There was a boat, the Olive May. It was wrecked down in the Rocky Reach. That's just before you come out of the 30 mile to the where the Hootalinka and the Yukon River join. And they were coming down. They had a bunch of cattle and sheep and stuff in the early days, and they piled up there, and the old hull was there. When I was a boy, it was still laying on the bank there, and there was, you know, bones of some of these animals there. I always thought that was maybe the boat that Robert Service referred to. You know, it was the Olive May, and I never heard of an Alice May on the river, but I think that's the one probably where they cremated Sam McGee.
You keep mentioning names of boats, Johnny. Just about how many boats were on the river? Do you have any idea how many boats were on the river at one time, or how many were on altogether?
Well, on the upper river, there was, I can name most of them in my time. It was the Casca and the Dawson, the Selkirk, the White Horse, the Bonanza King, and the Vedette. And the boat called the Norcom was on, too. It was the old Evelyn, it was an NC boat. They brought it and put it on the upper river when they had the rate war with the White Pass. The NC company owned the boats on the lower river, and the White Pass were on the upper river. Well, in 1913, the White Pass put two boats on the lower river, and then the NC and the White Pass got into a rate war, and they brought the Norcom up. They renamed the Evelyn the Norcom and put her on the upper river, and they cut the fares down, and you could go to White Horse for $5. And, of course, Barrington, he was on there with his boat, the Vidette, and old Cap Raymond with the Pauline, and $5 was the fare to White Horse. It was cheaper to ride up and down the river and want to stay in town.
Mm-hmm. So those are 8 boats. Well, then there'd be quite a few tied up here at one time, then, would there? I mean, say the end of the year, the beginning of the year, would there be quite a few at this dock here?
Oh, it is nothing to see 4 or 5 boats so tied up here. See the boats in the lower river that come up. That'd be the Seattle number 3 and the Susie and the Sarah and the Robert Kerr. It was a cold storage boat. It used to come up here with cold storage cows. They brought a lot of frozen meat in. And, then there was some private boats, too. The Washburn and the Reliance. And the American government had 2 boats, the Jeff C. Davis and the General Jacobs. They used to come in here. And a lot of these small boats, like the Reliance and the Washburn and those boats, they used to run on the smaller side streams down in the lower river. And they always came up in the fall, and they'd winter at the foot of the lake, because that's the only way they could get stuff into Alaska at that time. You see, there was no railroad or anything, and they all came down through here early in the spring. And then the White Pass and the NC and the AC company that had the boats, they used to bring the stuff in. And these boats, small boats, carried it up the side streams, like into Iditarod and all those different Talavana and all those different places along the river.
Johnny, it must have been quite a sight, though, in the spring when they all started coming in here. Then they'd have a large shore crew then, wouldn't they?
Oh, yes. And I'll tell you, when the first boat came in, that was really something. Everybody in town and on the creeks was in to see the first boat come in. Mm-hmm. And they had, they had a lot of longshoremen. See, there was 2 big docks here. The NC had a dock in the White Pass. And they were going night and day all summer long.
They were well equipped with cranes and loading areas and everything, were they?
Well, all they had was this chain for pulling the trucks off. Pretty near everything was handled by hand. Of course, they had a derrick on each dock for handling heavy machinery and that, but nearly everything was handled on trucks by hand.
Mm-hmm. And we have been talking in 3 of a series with Johnny Hogan about steamboating on the Yukon. And this is Athery Talick in Dawson City. For the last 3 weeks, Johnny Hogan has been telling us about steamboating on the Yukon. And we think we finished off about all the great amount of traffic and the boats that would be tied up here in the spring and the fall. Besides the business in Dawson, Johnny, the boats made quite a bit of difference in Whitehorse. Now, what would they do in the fall, and how many boats would be in there then for freeze-up?
Well, in the fall, the whole fleet would end up there, all but those few that they left, like at the foot of the lake, and sometimes there was three boats left at Hootalinqua. They built a yard there, and they used to haul two boats out there and leave one in the slough in later years. But they all ended up in Whitehorse, and then they used to haul them out. And that was quite a procedure, you know. They had these ways, and I'll go through the whole operation. We used to pull up to the commissary that was just above the dock in Whitehorse and unload everything, you know, like all our supplies and anything, like all the blankets and all the linen and everything for the passengers, and silverware, grub, and everything went ashore there. And then we dropped down to the shipyard, and we used to put these, when we were out in the river there, that was up to the crew, we used to put these lines around underneath the bottom of the boat, just about where the slings went on to pull them out of the water. And then we'd drop down and go right on, the skipper would set the boat right in on the end of the ways. Well, then we'd tie it up there, and then the yard crew would take over. Well, then they'd pull these big cable slings around under the bottom and over the top, and there was four on a boat, and they had a horse-powered capstans. They had four of them at the head of the ways, and they used to use the a two-inch manila rope and big blocks, and they'd hook on, and the horses walked round and round, and they used to yard these boats out. And then after they got them on the ways, well, then, of course, they had to jack them up so they were level and put them away. And, they'd drill a hole in the bottom and drain any water that was out in them. And then they checked them all, you know, for what repairs they needed in the spring, you know, if they, like landing on these gravel bars and wear and tear on the bottom way. Sometimes they'd have to put in quite a few planks. Well, they checked this all over in the fall, and they'd pull all the boats out first, and then pull the scows out last. Mm-hmm. And this was all done with horses. Well, they had quite a yard crew, and they had the jacks were all run by hand. They were just these screw jacks, and one man to a jack, and they had a whistle. And every time they'd blow the whistle, you'd take a turn on the jack, and if sometimes the fellows get talking a little bit, they got talking too much, the boss would come along and he'd say, take another turn on your jack, and let it tighten up. You didn't have any time to talk after that.
All horsepower and manpower. You wonder how they'd ever get them up. Well, then, this would be getting a well long into the fall, then, before they'd be finished, wouldn't it?
Well, it used to finish up late in October. Mm-hmm. The last boat used to leave Dawson pretty late then, 16th, 18th of October, mm-hmm. because they used to leave it as late as they could to bring the perishables down, like all the oranges and apples and eggs and stuff like that would come in on the last boats, you see, and that had to do then until, well, it'd be along in the latter part of November or December before they would get anything over the stage line in the way of perishables, because everything had to be crossed in canoes across the in the river, you know, in the ice.
Well, some of those last trips upstream, John, would be pretty tricky then with the steamboats. There'd be some fairly large chunks of ice in the river by then, would there?
Well, I can remember one the fall of 1919, we came down, we had a scow load of timber and stuff for some of the dredgers they were building over on Dominion then, and we had all the perishables, like oranges and apples and potatoes, carrots and all that stuff that, of course, it's mostly apples and oranges and eggs, and we got as far as Minto, and it was the 6th of October. Very early for the ice to start run. The ice started to run. It was on the Casca, and she was a fairly new boat, so they didn't want to risk her in the center down here. So we unloaded all the timber and everything, the scow at Minto, and then they sent the Dawson down, and I transferred down to the Dawson to come back home, and we came down with all this stuff. Well, it got pretty cold, and when we got to White River, you couldn't see any open water at all. We were right in the ice, and we had to pick up a bunch of big headhunters and people taking movies there at the mouth of White River, and it was impossible to stop. We just went in alongside the shore ice, got as close as we could. ran the foot plank out, and they just drifted along there, and they had to run along the shore ice, and we just got them aboard as fast as we could. The boat never stopped. We just slid right along with the ice. And it was that way all the way to Dawson. We got to up to Swede Creek here, just about 6 miles above Dawson, and they tried to start to turn around because we had to turn around to get into Dawson. We never got turned around. We got up just above the mouth of the Klondike here. And three or four of us jumped ashore on the shore ice just above the ferry, the old ferry landing with the lines, and kind of ran down the shore ice and hooked them onto the dock. And when they snubbed the lines, the boat stopped. She was away out in the river, and the river prisoner stopped. But we thought the boat, they thought they'd lost the boat, you know. They thought that was it for the winter. But we got busy and unloaded, because that ice, you know, on the wood, it wears the boats quite a bit. And we started that night to unload the boat, and it started to get a little warmer. And on towards morning, the ice started to let up, and about 3 days, the river was running clear. And there was two boats, the Seattle No. 3 and the Swatka. They were down below Eagle, and they had 300 passengers between them. No grub, and there was no airplanes those days to pick them up. There was a pretty serious proposition, because they had hardly any grub, you know. But they came through, too, and the whole bunch got through to Whitehorse fine. And they left here, I think it was the 15th or 16th of October when they left here. Whitehorse.
Just one of those freak years. You never know what would happen. Well, then, in the spring, Johnny, all this would be reversed then, wouldn't it? When would they start in getting the boats ready?
Well, they used to come in early in March. They used to come into the yard in Whitehorse, and you always knew when the coup was coming, because always the weather always got bad about that time. It was snowing and blowing. And, and then the carpenters and the yard crew would all come in, and then a little later, the boat crews would come in. They got a lot of work done pretty cheap with the boat crews, because the boys on the deck, and they only got $60 a month. The yard crew, the laborers in the yard, they used to get 3 1/4 a day. That was 10 hours. And, of course, the carpenters got a little more. Mm-hmm. But we used to do all the painting, and the crew did all the painting and anything we could prepare, the rigging, and get our stuff all ready for the summer, you know. And the carpenters, they looked after the repairs to the hull and that, and of course we had to help them too at times.
And then when would you start loading your, then you have to let the boats down off the ways. Would this be much of a job?
Yeah, well, when they had them, they'd have them jacked up level, you see. They had what they call a butter board they put under them. It was it was made out of heavy timber. It was like a shoe. It went over the top of the ways, but it held the boat level. And they'd shove these under, and then they were lashed at the upper end with rope to hold them. Then we'd let the boats down, put in jacks, you see, and jack them up, take the blocking out, let them down on these things. And then when they got ready to launch them, there was a man standing at each one of these things with an axe, and they'd blow the whistle, and you just chop this rope, and the boat would slide down into the river.
Gosh. And then this would be getting along into April, then, would it, by the time you're doing this?
It'd be in about, mostly around about the 1st of May before we put the boats in the water.
Mm-hmm. Then you'd be loading tons and tons of equipment and supplies and food and everything for your passengers, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes. It used to only take 36 hours to come down the river. And we used to have a lot of passengers, though, you know. It was nothing to have 90 passengers in the tourist season on one of the boats.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever on the first boat down, Johnny? What did it look like to see all these people on the dock?
Well, it was quite a sight. I came in one time on the first boat. I wasn't working for the company then. I was still with the dredging company at that time. But I came in on the first boat, and we left Whitehorse, the first boat, through the lake. We broke ice in the lake down below the island, and then we got stuck. The ice got too heavy, and we were, I think, 3 days there in the lake. You could get off and walk on the ice around the lake. And we broke this channel that far, and then we couldn't go any further. And then the little wind came up, and just a few hours, the whole lake broke up, and the boats had left Whitehorse just a few hours behind us. They came right through the lake right behind us.
And what were the people doing here? Would you get in here at any particular time, Johnny? Would you land in here at night sometime?
Oh, at any time. Whatever. See, it's daylight all the time then anyway. We didn't. But it didn't make any difference. The first boat was coming. Everybody was there.
And you'd whistle loud and clear around the corner, would you?
Yes, they used to blow quite a fancy whistle for the first boat and the last one. But it was a kind of a mournful sound, that last one.
I imagine it would. Johnny, they had fun down here with the steamboats, though, didn't they? They used them for outings and one thing and another.
Oh, yes. The Midnight Sun trip down to to Fort Yukon, that was... used to try and get down there by the 21st of June, and we always had quite a number of passengers. And there was a boat from the upper river and one of the lower river boats. Mostly always it was either the Alaska or the Yukon and the Kaska that went down on that. And, of course, at that time, they couldn't burn oil on the upper river. And these American boats, they burned oil as far as Eagle, and then they had to shift to wood, because they couldn't come up here on oil, and we burned wood all the time. So when they were burning wood, they could run right away from us, but when they were burning oil, but when they kept the wood, we could beat them, and we used to race coming back up, you know. It was kind of thing. And then they used to tie both boats together and have a big dance. They always try and get a steward department on the boats for the tourists here, that young fellows from college that played instruments, you know, and they'd have an orchestra on each boat.
Oh, and this was for the 21st of June.
Yeah. I remember one incident down at Fort Yukon. We were loading wood there the night of the 21st of June, and the sun was up. Of course, it never goes down there for about 3 days. It just goes around in a circle. And we were loading wood, and one old Indian came up to me, and he was watching these tourists, and they were all taking pictures and saying how wonderful it was. And this old Indian says to me, he said, "What's the matter with you?" He said, "No sun where he come from." He couldn't figure that out.
And, Johnny, they were just about the best days of all, weren't they, the days of the steamboat?
Oh, yes. You know, when the steamboats went off the river, I don't know, it was just the end of an era, that's all. It'll never be the same, to me anyway, or to a lot of people that remember it, because, when those boats came in, that boat whistle, you know, the first boat, of course, everybody was there, but it didn't make any difference during the summer. A boat whistle, everybody went to the dock that could, you know.
Mm. And those of us who have been in the country long enough, even to have gotten on the very last of the steamboat days, I still think are the fortunate ones. And we have been talking with Johnny Hogan about the steamboating on the Yukon. And this is Athery Talick in Dawson City.